So the topic of today's lecture is market efficiency. This is a key lecture in this module. What we want to understand is how do financial markets decide on the prices at which the different assets that trade in those markets, how does those markets decide what is a fair price? What informs that pricing? When I talk about market efficiency, I'm talking about how good is a particular financial market at pricing the assets that trade in that market. So if we're looking at a stock market, we're thinking in terms of the market's ability to price the shares of the different companies that are listed on that stock market. It's information that determines prices. It's information that informs trading. Prices are formed by trading activity. The buying and selling of shares in different companies, the buying and selling of bonds, if we're looking at the bond market. What's driving that trading activity is information, relevant information. How good is the market at doing this? We describe that as how efficient is the market at pricing assets. How efficient is the market at impounding new relevant information in its prices? I'm going to start by suggesting to you that there are two key dimensions to market efficiency. Does the market get the adjustment that it needs to make to prices when it receives new relevant information? Does it get that adjustment correct first time? Or does it have to make a series of adjustments until it gets it right? Does it overreact to begin with, only then to have to correct itself as time goes by? Well, in an efficient market, we'll get any adjustment right first time. So the accuracy of the adjustment is an important dimension of market efficiency. But so is the speed of response to any new relevant information. It's not enough that the market knows how to do its sums. It's not enough that the market can work out the correct adjustment to prices. It's also important that the market be able to do that very quickly, ideally immediately. So the second key dimension to market efficiency is the speed of response. So a highly efficient market will adjust prices immediately and correctly on receipt of new relevant information. Now there are two key words there at the end of that sentence: new and relevant. It's the arrival of new information that causes prices to change. But it's not any old information. It's information that matters. And so I could suggest a third dimension to market efficiency: the ability of the financial market to decide whether the new information is relevant or not. And that's the concept that I would like you to have in your mind. That an efficient market knows which pieces of new information are relevant and which are not. And when it decides the new information is relevant, it adjusts the prices of the appropriate securities. It adjusts those prices immediately and correctly. It gets things right first time, and it achieves that very, very quickly. I want to introduce you to the idea of what's called a random walk. Now, we cannot get terribly sophisticated about this. because the chances are we don't know enough mathematics properly to understand a random walk. The picture I want you to have in your mind is that what causes, e.g., share prices to change, is the arrival of new relevant information. And before that new relevant information hits the market, you have no idea what it is. You have no idea that it's coming. It's a complete surprise. You can't anticipate it. If you could anticipate it, you would do something about prices before that information hit the street. So it's important you understand that new relevant information is by definition something that you don't know about, something that you don't know is coming until it hits you slap bang in the face. If you're a financial market, you want to react immediately and correctly to having that new relevant information hit you slap bang in the face. The arrival of that new relevant information, therefore, is a random event. You can't predict it in advance. So market efficiency is all about how a market responds to the arrival of new relevant information. I've got a little cartoon at the foot of this slide. It should be beginning to become familiar to you. The horizontal line is a timeline. Normally I think of today as being time zero. I'm just trying to be a little bit fancier in labelling today as time little t. If you prefer to label that zero, that's fine. The next instant in time, I've labelled t plus one. The previous instant in time, I've labelled t minus one. Now these time intervals could be measured in seconds, they could be measured in minutes, they could be measured in days, or weeks, or months, depending on how rich the data set you have to study, to examine. So I'm not specifying what is the time interval. I want you to think of this world in which today we're at time t, and we can observe the share price of a particular security. Let's pick my favourite company, the one I used to work for, BP. So today we can observe the share price of BP. The last period, whether that be in seconds or minutes or days or whatever, the share price of BP was PT minus 1. Today we know this price because we can observe it in the market. We also know where the price was in the past. It's historical information. What we don't know today is what will next period's price be. The price could go up, the price could go down. What matters when we look at market efficiency is the change in the price. It's the change in the price that's being driven by new relevant information. If the market is truly efficient, we cannot predict what that change will be. We have no way of forecasting or predicting it if the market is truly efficient. So why do financial analysts spend any of their time at all in the real world attempting to forecast what the share price will do? Answer: because in the real world, they don't believe the financial market is perfectly efficient. If they're right, if there is some degree of inefficiency, then there is scope for forecasting or predicting share prices. And whenever you can predict where the price of an asset is going, you have the opportunity to make money. That's why the analysts are doing this. And we'll learn more about this, and in particular what they do, in a later lecture. But in today's lecture, I'm thinking about the hypothetical situation where I'm looking at a financial market that is perfectly efficient. There is no way anyone can forecast what the share price is going to do next. If they attempt to forecast what it's going to do, and then they sit back and watch to see what happens, and it turns out they were right, they were lucky. It doesn't reflect any skill on their part. It doesn't reflect any degree of inefficiency on the part of the market. They just got lucky on that one occasion. If we were to invite them to do the same thing again and again and again, we'd soon find they weren't always getting it right. So on average, over the long run, if the market is fully efficient, these financial analysts, roughly speaking, half the time, they're going to overestimate the change in price, and roughly half of the time, they're going to underestimate, so that over the long term, on average, they're not able to achieve anything. And that's a key hallmark of an efficient financial market. The behaviour that I'm describing, the manner in which this share price evolves, given that it changes in a random way in response to the arrival of new relevant information, that path that the share price follows is referred to as a random walk. Now, if you know more mathematics than I'm assuming, you'll know, wait a minute, there's more to a random walk than just that. Fine. I accept that, but we don't need to worry about that. This is a little bit nebulous. It's a little bit hard to get our heads around this. So I want you to think now about something much simpler and something that I'm sure you're familiar with. I want you to think about the following thought experiment, where I have a coin, and to begin with, it's fair. Which means it's as likely to turn up heads as it is tails if I toss the coin. So now we'll have a little rule. Each time I toss a head, I increase my score by plus one. Each time I toss a tail, I decrease my score by one. Now I've got to start somewhere, so let's start with a score of zero. If I were to toss the coin 10 times, and if it should happen that I toss heads 10 times in a row, my score is going to increase in steps of 1 up to a score of 10, because I reward myself with an extra 1 for every head. If over those 10 tosses of the coin, I'd tossed 5 heads and 5 tails, well, I'm going to bob up and down, but come the end of the 10th toss, I'm back where I started with, because each heads gives me a plus one, each tail gives me a minus one. The outcome of tossing the coin is something I don't know until I've tossed the coin. That's a piece of new information. It's relevant information because whether it's heads or tails is going to affect my score. So the outcome of tossing the coin each time mimics, in the financial markets, the arrival of a piece of new relevant information. Whether I adjust my score by one upwards or downwards, that's playing the part of the stock market adjusting the price. So my little coin-tossing experiment, whilst it is too simple, in truth, it is capturing some of the characteristics that I want. Namely, I don't know the outcome until the information hits me in the face, until I've tossed the coin and I can observe whether it's heads or tails. If the coin is fair, on average, I expect to throw heads as often as I expect to throw tails. Each outcome is independent of the previous outcome. I could, in theory, toss a head 500 times in succession. It's a most unlikely chain of events, but it's not impossible with a fair coin. When it comes to tossing the coin for the 501st time, it's still equally likely to toss heads or tails. So the next outcome is in no way influenced by the previous outcomes. The next change in the share price has nothing to do with past changes in share price. Emphasize the word change. The next change in share price has nothing to do with previous changes in share price in an efficient market. Why? Because changes in price are driven by the arrival of new relevant information, and by definition, that is random. That is a random event which we cannot forecast. Let me just put the lights down for a moment so you can see this a bit better. Here's a little simulation then of what might happen. Each time I toss a head, I increase my running total by one. Each time I toss a tail, I decrease my running total by one. Now this is a little animated cartoon. It's no more than that. But it's trying to convey the message. And the message is, if the coin is fair, so heads and tails are equally likely, on any one occasion I toss a head or a tail, that results in my running total increasing by one or decreasing by one. But if I toss the coin repeatedly a large number of times, so now I want you to look out to the right, on average, I don't expect to end up higher than I started or lower than I started. So what I want you to see in this little cartoon are two features. That the long run trend, if you like, is flat. And that superimposed on that long run trend are what I will describe as random fluctuations, some of which are upwards, some of which are downwards. Whether they're up or down reflects whether I've tossed a head or a tail. Let me put it now in the language of the financial markets. All other things being equal, the adjustment in the price is upwards if the piece of new information is good news. Similarly, if the piece of new relevant information is bad news, all other things being equal, the adjustment is downwards. So in my little coin tossing experiment, tossing a head represents a good outcome. Tossing a tail represents a bad outcome. And they play the part of the financial markets learning something good or bad about the company whose shares we are currently investigating. So my coin tossing experiment captures some of the key characteristics of how the stock market actually behaves. Yes, it's a simplification, but it's still useful. But even I can see a major objection. And the major objection I can see is that over the long run, I don't expect any gain. But investing in stock markets, bond markets, financial markets in general, is risky. And if I can take your mind back to the end of the lecture on financial arithmetic, we actually covered that at the beginning of yesterday's lecture, do you remember that trade-off? The greater the risk, the higher is the rate of return that investors demand. Well, in order to incentivize investors to invest in the stock market, for example, there has to be the expectation of a rate of return that exceeds what they could achieve by instead playing safe and just putting their money, say, in a bank account. I don't see that long-run gain. So in order to capture that missing feature, I have to make one important change to my experiment. Now the coin is not fair. Now heads are more likely than tails. How might that turn out were I to carry out a simulation? Well, it might go like this. Again, we have these random fluctuations from one instant to the next, as new relevant information hits the market. Each time I'm tossing the coin, I observe heads or tails, and I increase or decrease my running score by one. But now, because heads are a more likely outcome than tails, over the long run, so that's reading from left to right, there is now an upwards drift in my level, in my running total. Now, of course, in the stock market, the price adjustment isn't exactly plus one or minus one, but it is upwards or downwards. The size of the adjustment will reflect the intensity of the new information. Not only is it a piece of good news, it's seriously good news. So all other things being equal, the adjustment upwards will be bigger. I don't have that in my little model. The adjustment is always exactly plus one or minus one. But now that I have a biased coin, I have the two key features I wish. I would describe the top cartoon as representing a random walk. I would describe the bottom cartoon as representing a random walk with upwards drift. And a random walk with upwards drift, it turns out, is not a bad model of how the financial markets work. I'm a little bit worried that you don't believe me. You're sitting there very politely and quietly, which I appreciate. Maybe you're just doing that so as not to upset me. So maybe I could just take a sidestep. There's more than one way of doing this. There's more than one site on the web to go to. Here I've chosen the site Yahoo Finance. So the web address is uk.finance.yahoo.com, and I invite you to go have a look. Let's pick the FTSE 100. I introduced to you yesterday the idea of a stock market index. So the FTSE 100 is made up out of the 100 largest, by market capitalisation, the 100 largest stocks that trade in the London stock market. And here on the Yahoo website is the facility to build charts interactively. So here I'm looking at the FTSE, but I'm not interested in what the FTSE is doing today. Well, I might be in terms of my money, but not in terms of my teaching. I'm going to pick a reasonable long interval. That's what the FTSE has done over the past 2 years. And what I want to suggest to you, sure, there's been the odd point where the change in the level of the FTSE has been a bit more dramatic. And we can look back in time to see why that might be. But I would like to suggest to you that what we're actually observing here over the past 2 years is not so dissimilar to what I achieved with my little coin tossing experiment, where the coin was biased upwards in favour of heads. I have two key characteristics in reality. I have this long term, here the term is 2 years, I have this long term upwards drift in the level of the index, and superimposed on that long term upwards drift are random fluctuations. Some of those random fluctuations are upwards, some of them are downwards, reflecting the arrival of new, relevant information that was either good news or bad news. So my little coin tossing experiment, whilst it does not tell the whole truth, is not a bad thing to think about to get some idea of how the stock markets behave. And that's what I would like you to think about. Keep that in mind, and indeed when you go on and look at the seminar questions for next week, bear that in mind. Okay, some more theory. I'm now going to postulate a hypothesis. It was first put forward by a very famous finance academic called Eugene Fama. What I'm about to tell you, in summary form, was first published in the Journal of Finance in 1970. Now that is the top-ranked academic journal in finance, and Fama is the most highly cited finance academic ever in the world. Chicago academic. Fama attempted to classify how efficient a financial market was, and he suggested three levels of market efficiency. Unfortunately for me, he didn't choose the word level, he chose the word form. So we talk in terms of the three forms of market efficiency. Weak form, semi-strong form, and strong form. And as the names imply, as we move through that list, the level of market efficiency is increasing. So what did Fama mean by a weak form efficient market? He meant that today's prices already captured everything that was known about past prices. Now, there's an important implication there. If he's correct, there is absolutely no point studying past prices, because the market has already captured whatever there is to know and is relevant in that past price history has already captured it in today's price. You're not going to learn anything that's going to enable you to make money. So that's a weak form efficient market. Now let's up the level. A semi-strong form efficient market is one in which today's prices have consistently captured all public information. Now, public information includes past prices. Public information includes anything that is known about the company whose shares you're studying, anything that's known and is in the public domain. So that would be microeconomic information, micro at the level of the firm. But public information also includes macroeconomic information, what is known about the state of the economy. For instance, what you or I could read for ourselves in the Bank of England quarterly inflation report. All of that information is in the public domain, but it has to do with the macro level rather than the individual firm or micro level. And if a market is semi-strong form efficient, all of that information, to the extent that it's relevant, is already captured in today's prices. So again, no point studying any of it if what you want to do is forecast, work out where is the share price going next, so that you can do something about that to make money. What do I mean by that? If your forecast is that the share price will go up in the near future, then I think you'll be inclined to buy or recommend to someone with money to spare that they buy shares in this company before the share price goes up. What I'm saying to you is, if the market is semi-strong form efficient and you're basing your reasoning on public information, you're wasting your time. You might strike it rich next time, but you won't be able to do that consistently. You'll only get it right if you're lucky. And you won't be lucky again and again and again. Your luck will run out. What is a strong form efficient market? Well, perhaps I should say up front, there is no such thing in the real world. Nobody believes that a financial market is strong form efficient. So this level is introduced for completeness. This is an idealization. This is an idealization where today's price already captures everything there is to know, be that public information or private information. Now, private information is commercially sensitive information that only the main board of the company typically knows. We know that financial markets are not strong form efficient because we're aware of the phenomenon known as insider trading. Insider trading is illegal. Insider trading is making abnormal gain on the basis of private information that you have no business to have, or if you are entitled to have it, you have absolutely no right to trade on the basis of. That's illegal. It distorts the operation of the financial markets. The fact that we observe insider trading tells us that the market cannot be strong form efficient. It is possible to beat the market, but you need to be in possession of private information to do so. So I want you to remember Fama's classification scheme. But I want to help you remember. I want you to associate in your mind the three forms of market efficiency with three sets of information. Let's start with the lowest level of market efficiency, the smallest information set. That information set is the set of past prices. Now let me be absolutely clear. If we're looking at British Petroleum and the share price of BP, when I say past prices, I mean the past price of BP only. I don't mean the past prices of any other company like Shell or Exxon. It's past prices of the particular security we're talking about. So a market that is able to capture all of that information in today's prices is weak form. Let's now move outwards. Let's now take on board all other forms of public information. Notice we don't throw away past prices. The set of past prices is a subset of the set of all public information. It's nested within the bigger set. A financial market that's able to capture all forms of public information in its prices is labelled semi-strong form efficient. Let's now push it to its logical conclusion. If, in addition, a financial market can consistently capture private information in today's prices, then that market is labelled strong form efficient. Now, the little cartoon, I hope, helps you do the following. Remember the mapping between the information set and the form of market efficiency. But the little cartoon enables you to do more than that, and that will help with one of the questions in next week's seminar. Because the little cartoon helps you to see that a market that is semi-strong form efficient is automatically also weak form efficient. Because a market that's semi-strong form efficient is consistently impounding, capturing, in today's prices, all forms of public information. But public information includes past prices. Therefore, that financial market is consistently impounding in today's prices everything that's known about past prices. And by definition, therefore, it's also weak form efficient. So the little cartoon hopefully achieves two things. It reminds you of the mapping between the information set and the form of market efficiency, but it also allows you to start to draw some conclusions. Namely, strong implies semi-strong, implies weak, but not vice versa. The implications are spelt out if you have a read of the relevant chapter in the textbook. You can learn more about the implications. That was theory. The so-called efficient markets hypothesis, or EMH for short. How well does it stand up to empirical testing? We could probably have a whole module on empirical tests of the efficient markets hypothesis. That's a wee bit challenging for me, because I've got precisely 17 minutes left and there are other things I want to tell you about. So this is going to be a bit of a whistle-stop tour of some of the most famous empirical tests of market efficiency. The tests I'm going to tell you about are famous, but they were carried out many years ago. You should look at the textbook and the relevant chapter for more up-to-date tests. Now, generally, the message hasn't changed. It's been finessed. It would be useful for you to update yourself. The first such test I want to tell you looked at weak form efficiency, and you should write that down. This test is investigating the weak form of market efficiency. If a financial market is weak form efficient, you cannot consistently forecast the next change in the share price from knowing the previous change in the share price. In the jargon, successive price changes are uncorrelated. Just like in my coin tossing experiment, I cannot say what the next outcome will be simply because I know what the previous outcome was, or indeed the previous 500 outcomes. I learn nothing from knowing what's happened in the past. So what Bruno Solnit, another big name in academic finance, what Bruno Solnit did was to look at changes in the level of various stock market indices over different periods of time. One day, 1 week, 1 month. So what I want you to do in your mind is go back to that earlier slide where we had the little cartoon at the foot of the slide. You remember the timeline? Today was time t, the previous instant of time was t minus 1, the next instant of time was t plus 1, and we had the share price. Here it's the level of the stock market index. Last period, pt minus 1, this period, pt, and next period, pt plus 1. So Solnit looked at evidence to see whether there was any statistically significant correlation between the previous change in the level of the stock market index and the next change in the level of the stock market index. And he didn't want to be criticized for focusing on a particular stock market, so he indeed looked at stock markets in a number of different countries. I can summarise the results on this slide very quickly. He found no evidence of statistically significant serial correlation. In other words, none of the numbers in this table is statistically significantly different from zero. That's powerful evidence in favour of the weak form of the efficient markets hypothesis. Now let's up the ante and think about the semi-strong form of the efficient markets hypothesis. What I'm going to tell you about now, briefly, is the first of what's known as an event study. Lots of researchers since this first study have made use of this technique. This was the first one. Four people were involved. Your old friend Fama, who introduced the three forms of market efficiency, Fisher, Jensen, big name Harvard academic, and Rohl, another big name in academic finance. Far too many names to keep saying, so we call them FFJR. Fama, Fisher, Jensen and Rohl. They did this study 40 years ago. Why am I telling you about it? Because it was a landmark study. It was the first of its kind. It was an example of an event study. What was the event? The event in this case was a stock split. Now, to put it loosely, imagine at a point in time you have all these share certificates. You bought a share in the company, they give you a paper share certificate. They don't do that anymore. It's all done electronically. But just imagine you get a piece of paper that says you own one share. You get two pieces of paper if you own two shares, etc., etc. If the share price is getting higher and higher, it's getting harder for people like you and me to buy these shares. We're not that well off. So sometimes a company might decide to split its stock. And you can think of that loosely as they grab hold of each share certificate and say, tear it in half. So now you've got two shares, where previously there was one share, but now each of the two new shares is worth only half as much as the previous share. It's to make the shares more marketable. That's an example of a two-for-one stock split. It doesn't alter the market capitalization of the firm. In my example, we're doubling the number of shares, but at the same time we're halving the share price so that the product, number of shares times share price, doesn't change. So the expectation would be that a stock split has no effect on the value of the company. That is not what these researchers found. Now, without going into too much detail, just concentrate, if you will, on the topmost diagram. What the researchers were doing was measuring something called cumulative average abnormal return. All right. Their expectation before they undertook this study was there isn't going to be any. The stock split isn't going to make a hoot of a difference. But it did, because this cumulative average abnormal return rises. And that needs some explaining. Now, the abnormal return has to do with the share price beating the market. That's a higher return than we expected. The cumulative has to do with adding up all the little extra bits, all these little abnormal returns, say over each day, adding them up in order to make a big splash. And we need to do that in order to be able to measure the abnormal return. The individual abnormal returns over a day are typically very small and therefore difficult to establish whether they're statistically significant or not. Add them up, just like my running total in my coin tossing experiment, and you have the chance of starting to build up a big number, if indeed that's what's happening. The average in the story refers to the fact that the sample these researchers used involved a large number of companies. Each company was in the study because it had had a stock split. And so the idea of this averaging was there's one thing they all have in common, so whatever we observe can be traced back to that one common feature. Sure, They'll be subject to other influences as well. The share price of the different companies will be pushed up or down, buffeted up or down, by a range of different factors, only one of which is common to all of the firms. If we have a large sample and we average our measure, then all these other effects will average out. So whatever remains can be accounted for by the effect of the stock split. That's the logic behind this cumulative average abnormal return. Go back to this chart, but maybe now, if you have a pen or a pencil, I want you to superimpose what I'm going to describe, and that will simplify what is, after all, an observable. I mean, this is what actually was observed in the experiment. I just want to bring out the key features. So the first thing I want you to do is the following. Replace this part of the chart with a flat line. Make it horizontal. The second thing I want you to do, you have to look very closely at this. The second thing I want you to do is replace this piece, or highlight this piece, as a vertical line. The rest can stay as is. Now I need to make clear, what is the significance of this line that's labelled zero? Now, in the original study, that referred to the date of the stock split. And after they published this study, they realised they'd tripped up. Because what matters here is information. It's the announcement of the stock split that matters. So what they should have used as their point of reference isn't the date of the stock split, but the date on which it's announced. And that came sometime earlier. So we have to make that one adjustment. So along the horizontal is time, and zero, you might want to overwrite what's written at the foot of the slide, zero refers to the announcement date. So the horizontal axis is month relative to announcement of the stock split. They got that wrong. Nobody's ever got that wrong since. So what's happening is additional return is being achieved over and above what you expected as a result of the companies in the sample announcing a stock split. In other words, the announcement of a stock split is generally interpreted by the financial markets, here it's the US stock market, as a piece of good news. Why should the announcement of a stock split be interpreted as a piece of good news? Because when the researchers looked more closely, and that's what's happening in the rest of the diagram, they divided up their sample into companies that went on to increase the dividend per share compared to companies that went on to cut the dividend per share. And what they discovered was that in 80% of cases, a company that announced a stock split followed that up very shortly with the announcement of an increase in the dividend per share. That was the real good news. That's what the shareholders liked. That's what the financial markets liked. The announcement of the stock split heralded that. What's this got to do with market efficiency? The announcement of the stock split is a piece of relevant new information. Market efficiency is all about how quickly did the market adjust to that piece of new relevant information. Let's work backwards in time. The chart, the graph to the right of the announcement date, is essentially flat. There's no further adjustment. The market has got its adjustment right first time. It didn't have to have two or three goes at it. It didn't overreact, only then to have to correct that overreaction. No further adjustment was necessary. This piece of the trace, the vertical piece, points up an immediate reaction to the announcement. The change is happening immediately. That again is powerful evidence in favour of market efficiency. But there's more. What's going on here? To the left of the announcement date, In some instances, the market is anticipating the announcement. How does it do that? The market is always on the lookout for relevant information, new relevant information. How does the market get hold of that information? Answer, thanks to the financial analysts whose recommendations drive the subsequent buying and selling of securities like shares. Those financial analysts don't spend every day of their working life with their face glued to their computer screen, looking at complicated spreadsheets and the like. They spend a lot of their time visiting company headquarters and carrying out detailed interviews with the people who run the companies whose shares they're interested in. They pick up pieces of information. They pick up pieces of information that the market doesn't yet know. Those pieces of information, in turn, lead to active trading, buying or selling, depending on whether the piece of information is a piece of good news or bad news. So in some instances, the market was able to anticipate the announcement. That's better than semi-strong form efficient. That's not responding immediately to the public information in the announcement. That's making the adjustment, in some cases, before the announcement. Now, why is it a curve rather than a straight line upwards? Because we're averaging. We're averaging over a large sample, maybe as many as 500 firms. I don't remember, in truth. We're averaging over a large sample. In most cases, the adjustment occurs at the announcement date. But in some cases, the adjustment occurs before the announcement. But because what we're charting is this cumulative average abnormal return, the effect of the adjustment is slowed down. But wait a minute, there's another detail. If I focus my attention on the horizontal line, I see that I'm looking at time measured in months. This study goes all the way back 2.5 years before the announcement of the stock split. Am I seriously suggesting to you that the financial markets could anticipate 30 months in advance of the announcement that the announcement was coming? No. Because 30 months in advance, nobody would be thinking about a stock split. Nobody would know that anyone was planning to have a stock split. So how do I explain this first part of the curve? Answer, selection bias. What do I mean by that? I mean that typically the companies that have stock splits are companies whose shares are outperforming the market. That's why they're having the stock split. They're splitting the stock in order to make individual shares in the company more marketable, more accessible to a wider shareholder base, more affordable, if you like. So the first part of the diagram reflects the fact that there's selection bias. The firms in this study are typically all very successful. Their shares are outperforming the market. The curve that increases to the left of the announcement date reflects the fact that in some cases in this large sample, the market can actually anticipate the announcement. The vertical jump upwards reflects that in the majority of cases, the market adjusts the price upwards immediately on learning the news. Once the announcement is made, that information is in the public domain. So this immediate reaction to the release of public information is pointing up semi-strong form efficiency. And that's reinforced by the fact that thereafter, no further adjustment is necessary. The market is adjusting very, very quickly and correctly first time its prices.